Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Well, good morning and welcome to Driven to Business. I am Eddie Mayfield, and we're glad to have you here on Biz 1190. A recent article in the Financial Times quoted President Barack Obama saying that by 2020, the U.S. will be a net exporter of natural gas. Now, Driven to Business is not an investment program. There are plenty of people with a lot more knowledge than I have right here on Biz 1190. And I don't, as a rule, give investment advice. But I am a private investor. And as such, I do pay attention to trends and what I see as investment opportunities. And I've been interested in the natural gas industry for some time. Many of you are aware of the increased supplies of both oil and gas, but most of you are probably not familiar with exactly how much this increase has been. It's unprecedented. The United States has incredible reserves of natural gas. And the price of natural gas here in our country as compared to the rest of the world is an unbelievable bargain. Any idea of how much natural gas we presently export? How about zero? But that's probably about to change, and it could well usher in an unprecedented economic boom here for us. But the boom in natural gas is not just tied to export. There's a wealth of applications for natural gas right here at home, and it's almost certain that you, regardless of where you live or what business you're in, are going to benefit. Our next guest is an industry leader in this field. His name is Brian Batson. Brian is a Senior Vice President of Southern Operations with AGL Resources. In that position, Brian is President of Atlanta Gas Light, Chattanooga Gas, and Florida City Gas. Brian is an old friend. Brian is not just in the gas business. Brian's active in his church. Brian is on the board of the Boys and Girls Club of Metro Atlanta and the Grady Health System Board of Visitors. Brian's a great guy. Brian, glad to have you here. Hello.
Good morning, Eddie, or good afternoon. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. Brian, natural gas is one of these commodities that we don't think about very much until and unless there's an interruption. But, you know, there's a very complex infrastructure that lets a cubic foot of natural gas that's originating in a well somewhere in Oklahoma to show up in Eddie Mayfield's basement and be burned in his furnace. Can you just walk us through how that gets there?
Sure, Eddie. It's probably about like you would think, but you have producers who are out there searching for the gas and drilling to find the gas. And once they have gathering wells, in other words, in the fields, they bring that gas into a point and put it into pipelines of the interstate pipeline companies. Now, these are companies that are large, like a Kinder Morgan or Transcontinental Pipeline, that move gas from across the states into the U.S. from areas that have plenty of gas to areas that need gas. And so originally in the U.S., if you looked at our pipeline systems, they originated down into the Texas and in the West and in the Gulf and moved gas across the South, turned and went up the East Coast. That's just the way it's developed over time. Now, as we run into differing types of supplies, there are actually large supplies now up in Pennsylvania in the shale, as well as the shales that are in Texas. But the Northeast has its own supply, which it has not had, which is sort of starting to change how the pipelines look at this thing. So these large pipelines put pressure on this gas and move it across the country and deliver it to local distribution companies, or LDCs, and that's what Atlanta Gas Light is, one of those, the biggest in the Southeast. We have about 1.6 million customers in Georgia. Chattanooga, which is the smallest of the utilities that I'm responsible for, has 60,000 customers. And then again, down in Florida, we have just over 100,000 customers. So we have differing size companies, and there are more than just those three that I mentioned across the South and up and down the East Coast. And we take the gas off the gate stations from the higher pressures as it moves across the country, reduce it to lower pressures, and then push it through our system through several steps of lowering the pressures until it gets to your house. It comes up, goes through another regulator at the house, and it puts it at 7 inches water column. which is about a quarter of a pound, and that's what most appliances use. There's exceptions to everything that I'm telling you, but most appliances use the quart. They cut that 7 inches down to about a 3 or 4 inches for actually running the water heater or running the stove. So that's how the gas gets from A to B, is it sort of goes from a producer to a transporter to a distribution company and then into your home.
Does gas, Brian, does gas require refining? Is it pretty much, do we get it?
They do refine it some, Eddie. It depends on if it has what they call heavies. And when I say heavies, you have heard terms of butane, hexane. So what's called hotter gases, they remove it to get it to the right BTU content, which is the natural gas BTU content. Natural gas actually comes out of the ground sort of odorless and colorless. We add a chemical called mercaptan, which sort of smells like a rotten egg. And we do that so that if it's in someone's home and they actually have a leak of some sort, can detect that. Otherwise, you would not know it's there. It's colorless, odorless, and lighter than air. That's one of the things that makes natural gas very safe relative to some of the other gases that are out there. Propane is heavier than air. Though, right. If you've ever been with propane, if you spill it, it goes to the ground. Natural gas is hotter than air or lighter than air. So if you put it in a balloon, so to speak, it would rise just like a helium balloon would rise because it's a 0.6 specific gravity. So we do some things to make it where you can know the presence is there, knowing that it's about as safe a natural gas component as you can use.
Brian, in our company, we work on the unlike you, we're not in the gas and the oil business, but we do work on some of the infrastructures. And in fact, I have a guy today, one of our guys is today on an offshore platform working on a natural gas compressor that's actually compressing the gas to put it into a pipeline to take it ashore, where it will be whatever they do when it gets to the plant there, and then it'll be distributed. This particular one happens to be off on the West Coast out there. And then we do some work on the pipelines, the variable frequency drives on the pipelines themselves to pump it and compress it and get it there. Brian, the International Energy Agency has said in one of their articles that they think we're entering the golden age of gas. It's an interesting term, the golden age of gas. From your perspective as an industry leader, what's this golden age of gas going to look like?
Well, I think what we will find, Eddie, is because it's American, abundant, and affordable, and we can go into various reasons later why those three statements are very true. I think that allows America to begin to utilize a resource that we have, full control over, and that is here on our continent, that we can then use in most every application that you can think of from energy perspective. Where we can run most anything that you run on gasoline can be ran on natural gas. So as a country, our dependency on foreign oil and all the things that go with that, without getting into the politics of whether you like it or you don't like it, the fact is the Middle East has been in turmoil and probably will be in turmoil at various times for years to come. Our ability to rely on what we have here and what we have control of here, I think, is certainly worth America's focus. So I think that's why they're saying it's the golden age, is price. If you look back before the discovery of shale gas coming out of the Gulf, we had spikes in price, and there was some concern about the amount of the product and the supply. With all the shale gas and all the new technology that they put into place, we now have a 100-year supply. Now, I don't know what will happen in 100 years, and between now and then, they may find another 100-year supply.
I'll probably be an adult by then, perhaps.
Yes, I'll be grown enough to not care, I think, at that point. But when you look at that and realize that it's cost-effective, you know, the cost-effective ability to produce this gas. Shale gas, they used to have gas selling at around $6 or $7 per MMBTU, a unit of measure. It doesn't matter what it stands for, but it's a unit of measure. And during some of the Katrina and Rita, gas spiked up to $12 and $15. And so the end consumer could feel that pain. Now, shale gas can be competitive, and it was competitive as being consumed in a $3 market. And gas is probably $3 to $4 right now, depending on where you're buying it. And that is a world of difference when you think about something being a third of the price of what it was just in 2005. because of the new technologies and the new ability to find this gas within the shale conformations and without throughout Louisiana, Arkansas, Texas. They've got it up North Dakota, South Dakota, Pennsylvania, New York, although New York's still arguing over not whether they want to allow the extraction, but it's there. And so the U.S. has such an abundance now and the ability to find it. The best description I heard is I was talking to a producer, and he said it is no longer – our job is not to find the gas. It's not exploration. It is manufacturing. He said we are in a manufacturing-type process where we can tell you there is gas here, we can tell you how much we can get, and we just need to find out if there's a market that we can take it to. It's, you know, people probably think of the old days of the folks, you know, using dividing rods, looking for water, looking for oil. You always think of that. They have such advanced systems now that they can scientifically, they know where the deposits are. They know what they will be able to pull out of those deposits, and they're able to go down and access it when there is a market for the gas.
You know, I think the public is aware because we've all heard about that there's a lot more oil and gas out there. But I really think, Brian, that the public is unaware of, as I said in the beginning of the program, that the public is unaware of exactly how much and what that really means. And I think you've done a great job of describing it. You know, the other thing I want to talk to you about after the break is we're down to relatively inexpensive natural gas here. But that's not true throughout the world at all, is it? It's a very different picture.
Absolutely. Europe and Japan, these folks who are very dependent on LNG, and that's a different term. It's the same product, but it's liquefied natural gas. And they are paying...
And we have 30 seconds here, by the way.
All right. Well, they're paying... We're used to $4 gas. They're often looking at $13 and $14 gas.
Right. Exactly. Which means the export side of this, which is something I'll talk to you about in a little bit, is incredible, along with the fact that we really have got an incredible opportunity here for using inexpensive energy, homegrown. It makes us independent of a lot of other things that we're into right now. Brian, we'll be back. If you can hang on during the break, we'll be back in just a few moments. Today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. You are listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Here on Driven to Business, we believe in the free market. We celebrate the entrepreneurial spirit. We admire business success, and we learn from its failure. And we have a great guest for us today. His name is Brian Batson. Brian is a vice president with AGL Resources. He's an expert in the natural gas business, is what we're talking about. Brian, right before the break, we were talking about the price of gas, and I had the opportunity to ride with you not too long ago in your natural gas car. Brian, can I buy a natural gas car?
You can, Eddie. Right now, Honda is the only manufacturer that is making a totally dedicated, meaning that my car runs off of natural gas and natural gas only. Many of the other manufacturers have a bi-fuel that runs off of both gasoline and natural gas, so they have two fuel rails on a computer such that when they run out of the natural gas, it will switch over to gasoline. But yes, you can, and I think more and more people are doing that. Certainly, the homeowners are a little slow on the adaptive end because they don't really understand all the benefits and the cost benefits associated with that. But I can tell you that the fleet owners are moving very rapidly, especially those who park at one place either all day or all night, so they can use what's called a slow fill system. So trash trucks, municipalities, and those types of folks are going very quickly because of the cost savings and the cleanliness of the fuel and just the usefulness of that capability. The cost savings is there. In America, you don't do something if it doesn't make sense, and folks are starting to do that from a cost perspective.
Brian, how do we, if I had a natural gas vehicle, I mean, where would I fill it up?
Eddie, there are numerous public stations. But you can, you know, just like with everything in America, if you Google natural gas filling stations, they will show you on a map wherever they are across the U.S. And what you would see is about what you would expect is, you know, the Southeast is a little thin. There's growing. Metro Atlanta, when I first got my car, there was only two places I could fill up. Now there's about seven or eight, and I expect them to be another seven or eight over the next year or so. But if you looked at Oklahoma, if you look at Utah, if you look at California, it is almost, I won't say it's unlimited, but there's really no constraint on your ability to fill up. They have a bit had that ability. They've made sure all their major interstates have fuel stations as they move up and down those interstate systems. And then the customer has the right and the access. And they will actually show you the price on a gallon equivalent. So you don't have to learn a new measurement system. They price it on the equivalent gallon. And so, for example, in Georgia right now, I would probably, if I went to a public station, pay about $2.20 a gallon. If I were in Oklahoma and I went to a public station, I'm probably paying $1.30. And that's just because they have a lot better supply, a lot more vehicles, and a lot more demand. You can fill up at your home. You can buy a station. Our company has the ability. You can lease for $50 a month a home fill unit that will fill your car up at your house, and you'll end up paying roughly the equivalent of $1 a gallon to run your vehicle.
That's actually astonishing. And again, knowing that makes me think we are in fact entering a golden age, and it's going to look like they had a great deal. The companies that are expanding their fleets, now, if I understand correctly from what I'm reading, along the I-95 corridor, for instance, there are plans now to be putting in natural gas stations along. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, Eddie, the systems will have to be put in place in order for folks to get comfortable. I mean, I guess the biggest constraint I would say to a natural gas vehicle now is people put it simply, they wonder if they can go visit grandmother or not. You know, you can't go from A to B, and people are not used. We're used to finding a gasoline station pretty much anywhere we want to. And you look back over your lifetime when you were a young kid, they weren't as frequent, and you didn't have gas lights that would come on. I've run out of gas in my lifetime. That's just not something people are comfortable with. But as the stations get implemented, as the major trucking industry moves into both LNG and CNG, CNG being compressed natural gas, LNG being liquefied natural gas, you'll see more and more stations. You'll see more and more access to that, and people will get more comfortable with that process, and you'll begin to see more vehicles that are produced that allow you to. Right now, it's probably most, as in my house, we have more than one car, and the running around car is the little natural gas car, and we still have a car we go out of town on vacation with as well.
Yeah, I was unaware until very recently that you could actually buy a compressor to put at your house and actually by using the natural gas that's already coming to most of our homes and actually fill your car with that. I was completely unaware of that. Brian, on the tank, obviously, for the compressed gas that's going into a natural gas car, obviously the tank has got to be a little different.
It is, Eddie. It's a composite material. The tank that I have on my Civic is an 8 gallon tank, and I think that'll be that is one of the areas that they're focusing on research and development around the tank. 3M's doing a lot of work trying to make tanks smaller, more compact, better fitted for the today's cars, and on the compressor that you would put at your home that would fill that car. Those are the two areas that are the breakthroughs, because those are the two major costs. And the compressor, when it started out, it was around $5,000. They now have it under $4,000. And I think everybody thinks the magic number is at $2,000, it will almost become a normal thing. That's why we went with a lease program, because people weren't sure about it. They didn't know about it. So for $50 a month, you can lease the compressor, and we maintain it as well. So that seems to take some of the reservations off from the general public and their ability to do that. And then the tank itself is very strong, very safe, and just part of the whole system within where you – it does take up some room in my trunk, and that's just because they haven't built that into the frame yet that I think over time will become just a normal process, just like your gasoline tank is built into the frame of your car.
You know, people that sometimes question the safety of natural gas, I sometimes remind them about gasoline. I mean, take a bucket of gasoline and throw it in a fire somewhere and see what happens.
Well, if you think about it, natural gas being lighter than air, if for some reason you were in an accident, it's going to relieve. It has a built-in relief valve, and that is going to the atmosphere. You can have the same kind of wreck in a Chevy Suburban, and you've got 40, 45 gallons of liquid fuel that's just as combustible that you could be laying in. I mean, so all energy has to be harnessed. All energy, you can have an accident with energy, whether it's electricity, propane, butane. So it's about managing that and understanding those risks and taking the proper care. And natural gas having been here, natural gas was here in Atlanta before Sherman marched through. So it has a long history. And it was originally used to light the streets in Atlanta.
I was going to ask you about that. You know, when I first saw the name of the company, when I first moved here, Atlanta Gas Light, just stupidly being an electrical guy, I just thought that you guys must sell electricity as well. But tell us about that. I just read that recently, really, how Atlanta Gas Light got started. Tell us about that.
Yeah, originally there were some businessmen that came together, and obviously from safety, from what would be a major city at its time, they put streetlights up, and it ran off of natural gas. So there are companies that are gas and light, and those are typically gas and electricity combination companies. But we're a natural gas-only company. And we started out, homes at one time had gas lights. I've seen some over in Augusta where you actually had gas going through a line and lighting lanterns in the ceiling. So natural gas was used for light originally here, and as it's morphed into more and better uses, more around the energy of, you know, nothing beats natural gas for heating a home and heating water and cooking. I mean, those are three things that nobody can touch us on. And that's the most efficient way to use it.
I absolutely agree with that. When it's there, we've had gas dryers and everything else, and they're just much easier to use, much hotter, and they work quite well. I want to remind everyone that today's program will be on eddiemayfield.com. That's E-D-D-I-E, Mayfield.com, a podcast of today's program. And you can hear this all again at the end of the program, along with some interesting links on some natural gas information that we'll have on there that you can read about. Brian, can you stay with us during the break?
Absolutely, Eddie.
Okay. We're going to be talking with Brian after the break, and later on in the program, we're going to be talking with another guest we have here who's a sales trainer and sales coach, and don't miss that. This is Philip Saxton who will be with us. We'll be back. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield here on Biz 1190. We're talking with Brian Batson with AGL Resources here in town. Brian, before we finish, I was going to talk to you a moment about, I've been very interested in the potentials of the LNG, liquefied natural gas export market. And there are a number of industry analysts who, as you know, suggest that this could trigger one of the largest economic booms to hit the U.S. in decades. I know that your primary interest is in domestic supply of natural gas, but I'm just wondering what are your thoughts and observations on the natural gas export business?
Eddie, we know LNG as a corporation. We have three different liquefaction plants here in Georgia that we use to store gas for those coldest winter days when we need more gas than we can buy off the pipeline. I think you will see some export abroad just due to the difference in supply. But you have to practically look at where can the U.S. export LNG from, and there are not that many places that can happen. You've got Maryland, Louisiana, and Texas that each have a few points on the coast there where they could actually get the gas, get it liquefied, and get it in a tanker and get it moving overseas. But there are just not an overabundance of places that you could send that gas out of the U.S. I think they will operate. They've applied. But if you look at the use of natural gas through 2022, the smallest sliver of use would be LNG net exports. And that's just due to the fact that there's only so many places that you can liquefy and send it out of the U.S. I think it's viable from a financial perspective. It's just a it's an expensive proposition, and there aren't that many places that can do it right now.
I think the only place that's set to come online right now is a company called Cheniere Energy.
Which is
out in Houston, but I think their export facility is actually in Louisiana, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, and I know Cove Point in Maryland is looking to do the same.
Are they? Okay. And, you know, one of the things we had talked about that makes that, I think, interesting to people is it is expensive to do it. But when you look at the price of natural gas in Europe and Asia, and that is multiples of what we pay here in the United States, I think that's why it perhaps has business people looking at that thinking that's and there's a shortage of it, I might add, in some of those areas. You know, England, there was an interesting story in England at the you know, they had this winter that lasted on and on and on, and a very cold spring. And England actually came down, they didn't do it, but they came down to planning on rationing natural gas in England, which again points out how fortunate and blessed we are here in the United States with having the abundance we have of that we're not anywhere close to rationing gas in the United States, and even with the expanded usage we're going to have of it. So really, Brian, you're in a good industry, aren't you?
I'm in a great industry.
Brian, you've had a very successful career. How did you get started?
Eddie, I came out of college as a field engineer who knew little to nothing, actually, as most of us do when we come out of college, and came to work for the company then. They were in the process of hiring engineers and bringing them in and putting you in the field and just letting you, you know, learn from the truck, so to speak, and learn how we do business, and then have moved to various different jobs over time and supervisory jobs and managerial jobs as they've given more and more things to say grace over, and I've enjoyed all of it. It's all been different, but all the bigger picture of how the industry operates.
Brian, have you had one of the things that helped me a great deal when I first got in the business that I'm in was there were two fellows out in Houston that decided to take a gamble on me and let me run a department in their company, and I learned almost everything I know about the business I'm in from them. Are there any mentors along your way that?
Yeah, the gentleman who hired me when I went to the Marietta Service Center, Paul Lawson, was a superintendent. He was the old-timey guy who, you know, grew up in the truck and knew the business and was practical, and he just was willing to teach you if you were willing to learn.
Yeah, that is an amazing deal. You know, I also know that, like me, you get a lot of pleasure out of mentoring and teaching younger people, and especially you have spent a lot of your life invested in mentoring and teaching young men. Tell us about that.
Well, I at our church, Mountain Park First Baptist, I teach Sunday school, and I love teenage kids. They're smart. Sometimes they think they know things that they don't know, but I like to stay busy. I like to have fun. And in the meantime, like to give them some education on life as they move from it. You know, most teenage boys will talk to oftentimes people other than their parents in right. ways that they won't talk to their parents. And so I enjoy playing that role and have enjoyed that for quite some many years here in Atlanta for 12 years, and before that 5 or 6 years in Augusta while I was over there. So I do enjoy that.
You know, it's a rewarding thing, isn't it, to when you and many of us now have seen these young guys grow up and get married and start families, and you the fact that you know you had an investment in them is a rewarding feeling, isn't it?
It is, and it's also making me feel older the more I see them get married and have children.
Exactly. Of course, you have a daughter now. You're about to become an empty nester yourself.
Girl who's now 18. Yep.
Exactly.
The one thing I've you know, in today's employees, the younger employees, it is interesting. The dynamics are different than what you and I grew up with, and so you have to learn how to deal with that. People are expect to move much faster, expect to have much more responsibility sooner, and are not as invested in waiting. And I don't, you know, I guess that's just a function of everything. Everything is faster, from the microwaves to the iPads to the texts. Everything happens faster, and they're used to having it faster. So there's a challenge there with young folks, and I just try to teach them to humbleness is clearly your strongest asset, in my opinion. I always send them texts, and I send them Proverbs 26, 25:6-7 a lot of times says, do not put yourself forward in the king's presence or stand in the presence of the great, for it is better to be told, come up here, than to be put lower in the presence of a noble. And what I'm saying to him is, you know, don't act like you know something that you don't. Admit, be willing to admit what you don't know and ask for the assistance, and anybody will be glad to render it. It's a lot worse in life for somebody to have to say you don't really know what you're talking about and push you down than is to say, come up here and let me show you. And so I try to get them to think along those lines of things don't have to be instant and you don't have to know everything, because, you know, we all, at 19, we all were geniuses in our own mind. And I think it's just being willing to know that you're not, and being able to admit that and know that that's okay, I think is when you can come to grips with that, you can start to move forward.
I always think in Ecclesiastes when it says, you know, the older I get, the more I learn, the more I find that I don't know. I think that's sort of the paradox of life, isn't it?
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing.
You know, Jim Collins, whom I had the opportunity to hear speak a number of times. I've read all of his books. Jim Collins, those that don't know, he's the author of Good to Great and a number of other books. And, you know, he says that when he began examining what the type of leader that took a company from being a good company to a great company, that he found to his surprise, in fact, to hear him tell it, he had his researchers go back and look again because he didn't believe it at first. To his surprise, he found the most common attribute of a great leader was humility. That doesn't surprise you, does it?
No. I mean, Eddie, you've been around it, and you've been very successful. I mean, your ability to realize what you don't know and admit it, and then get the people who do know that, and being able to spot that. I mean, you don't have to be good. You just be able to hire the smart folks who can do the work for you. When I'm talking to our managers and our supervisors, you know, you can show them a piece of rope and say, now, how would you push this? And they're like, well, you can't push rope. That's right. You can't push people to do things. You've got to pull them. You know, they got to feel like you're with them. That doesn't mean you have to be out there every day in the truck riding, but they have to feel like you're pulling for them, that you've got the rope and you're helping pull them along and not trying to push them out in front of you.
Brian, I've learned. I've served on several committees with you at church, and I've learned from serving on there with you that you often sit back. We'll have a meeting with 12 or 13 people, and there you and everyone's talking and perhaps arguing, and you're always a guy that doesn't say a word. Usually you sit back and listen until the very end, and then you seem to speak up and sort of put everything in perspective. I've always wanted to ask you, and I'm not putting you on the spot, is that a control strategy you've been trained to do, or is that just your natural way?
My wife would tell you I'm not. That is not my natural way. So, but I have learned that if I will sit quiet and listen and try to hear each person's perspective, that gives me a better chance to find a common ground for all the perspectives. I don't know if it's trained, but I've learned, I guess I would say, whether it's trained or it's learned, I've learned that just sitting through and listening and let each person express and seeing if there's a way to pull the threads together. And for some reason, I at least have not an uncanny ability, but the ability to sort of hear where there's some uniformity of thought and try to pull the people into that process to get them to go forward. And, you know, I found that if you start out opening your mouth to start with, you haven't heard what people have to say. You're better off to get all your advisors and listen to all your pieces from people and then set your plan to move forward. So I guess I wait on purpose because I know all those people are very smart and everybody has a good opinion. It's, does it fit, and how do you make all those opinions fit together? That's sort of how I try to approach it.
You know, it's an old saying, and we've all heard it, you know, that God gave us two ears and one mouth, and we tend to exercise the mouth a lot more than we do the ears, which doesn't make any sense. But, you know, listening really is, to me, it's a hard thing. I have to work at that. But I have learned that when I'm talking or negotiating something with someone, if I'll just sit and listen rather than being so quick to speak, it actually does work to everyone's benefit, mine and theirs, because we at least get clarity and we get to understand one another without me assuming I know what he's thinking about something.
We feel compelled to give an answer. And oftentimes, even if we haven't had a chance to think about it long enough, we still feel compelled to get an answer. And if there's silence, we feel more compelled to give an answer. But I still think we need to take time, like you say, to listen to what was said and listen to the counsel. Again, I love Proverbs. And Proverbs 15:22 talks about, it says, without counsel, plans fail. but with many advisors, they succeed. And I found that to be true in life. It's not what I know, but it's who all can I ask and get their opinion that I can put all that together to get a good answer.
Brian, we have 1 minute.
All right.
When you're gone, which I hope is no time soon, but how do you want to be remembered?
I want to be remembered as a good husband and a good father. And I want someone to think that I had high expectations of myself and of others. I tend to look at life half full. You can choose, I've told my daughter, happiness is a choice. You can choose to be happy or you can choose to be down and out. Because there's going to be enough things in life that kick you in the teeth or the rear, whichever one hurts the worst. And it's how do you look at that? How do you handle that? How do you respond that defines you? Not what happened to you, but how you react to what happened to you.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us. It's been very interesting. I appreciate you being here, and I hope you'll come back sometime.
Natural gas is wonderful anytime.
It absolutely is. Thank you.
See you.
This is Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Remember, you can hear more of Brian by listening to the podcast on eddiemayfield.com. This is Biz 1190. We'll be back. She held him up and he held up. Welcome back to Driven to Business. We believe in the free market. We celebrate the entrepreneurial spirit, and we admire business success. We learn from failure, and we're going to try to present sound business principles and leadership grounded in hard work and ethical business practices to help you succeed in your career in business, regardless of where you are. And along those lines, in the studio with us, we have Philip Saxton. Philip is the founder of an organization called Small Business Samaritans, whose motto is "We Come Aside." Hi, Philip.
Hi, Philip. Glad to be with you, Eddie.
Well, thank you, Philip. I have had the opportunity to be with you at some of the Small Business Samaritans meetings, and you know you just tell us about the what's the concept behind that?
Well, the concept, of course, is based upon the story in the Bible of the Good Samaritan. If you know that story, then you know what Small Business Samaritans is all about. We come alongside small businesses to help make them successful. And success to us is keeping them in business, helping them make more of a profit, growing their business. And the exciting thing is to take a business from where it is today and get them to the point where they can hire an additional employee. That is success.
So you're just, you know, having attended some of your meetings, that you'll cover topics anywhere as diverse as sales or customer service or marketing or communications and things of that sort. All of which, you know, many of us starting in business, you take some fellow that's a plumber and decides to start a plumbing business. Well, he knows how to be a good plumber, but he's never run a business. And so you can find, perhaps he doesn't have any idea, how do you go find customers? How do you invoice? How do you collect? But those are the things that you're trying to help them with, isn't it?
That's exactly right. One of the things we discovered is that many, many business people don't have the budgets or the time for personal development and training. And so we host a monthly seminar at the Hamilton Mill Golf Club, where we spend 4 hours with entrepreneurs, teaching them in various areas, customer service, women in business, financial management, insurance, sales techniques, communication skills, all of these kinds of things that people need to have in order to run a successful business. We find that businesses don't fail because of lack of capital. They fail because of lack of know-how.
I would agree with you about that. And you know, the problem is that lack of know-how can end up being such a frustrating thing. I know when I first got started in business, I would sometimes run into things and just have no idea how to deal with this. Now, fortunately for me, I was active in church and in other organizations, and there were successful business people there. Philip, the first time that I got put in charge of a department out in Texas, a guy who really gave me the first leadership position I ever had. It was a small company. They grew to be quite large before I left there. But he told me I was responsible for the profit and loss of a particular department there. And they gave me the P&L statements for that department, and we were going to have a meeting the next day and discuss them. And I was going to discuss them in front of a bunch of people. And I'd never seen a P&L statement before. So at church that evening, I went by and found a buddy of mine who happened to be the controller for a large company out in Houston. And I said, I need your help. And he sat down and for about 30 minutes just explained everything on those balance sheets to me. Mm-hmm. But not everybody has those kind of people in their life they can turn to and get help like that.
You'd be surprised that most people don't have people like that in their lives to turn to. That's why Small Business Samaritans is there. If we don't have the skills necessary to help a small business person, one of the things that we want to find out from them by meeting with them free of charge is to understand what their deficiencies are, identify what those are, and then find help for them to help them in those areas where they are not strong. You know, one of the things that that an entrepreneur should do is that they should really work on delivering excellent products and services, and they're usually pretty good at that.
Right.
But there are dozens of other things that they're not good at that they need help with, and we can find people for them to work with them to help them in those areas and therefore give them an increased chance of success.
By the way, those of you, I want to, before that we get too far in the program, you can, Small Business Samaritans has a website. It's smallbusinesssamaritans.com. So you can go there and find out how to contact Philip. And like I say, they meet every month up in the, up 85 North here in the Atlanta area, up in the, in the Hamilton, at the Hamilton Mill Golf Club. And it's, you register, you get a full breakfast, and then you get the 4 hours of training. And you can do two things. If you are already an established business person, well, it never hurts any of us to review what we don't know. Our last guest, Brian, talked about humility being a fundamental leadership characteristic. And I could not agree more about that. And part of being an humble person is understanding you don't know everything, and that no matter how much you may know about something, there's more to learn about it. And I always look at anyone as having something to teach me. And when we do a good job in our company at customer service, that doesn't mean we're perfect at it. And also, that's one of those things that you continually have to work on, no matter what size business you are. You have to work on that. And so if I can go there and hear someone else talk about what they do in customer service, perhaps it helps me to go back to my company and do a better job. And the other thing is, if you are a successful business person, Philip would probably like to have you speak out there, because you could then share some of your expertise and help out people who have not perhaps had the experiences you've had and don't have the resources you've had, and you can really help someone along. And that's a very fulfilling thing for any of us to do. Philip, how'd you get the idea to do this?
Well, I was just thinking about businesses, small businesses, and I've done a lot of small business consulting. And, one of the things that I discovered was revealed to me was that many, many businesses need help. They need someone that they can call. They need someone that they can ask questions of. They need someone to talk to that really understands them. If you are a owner of a business, very often you can't talk to your employees. Being a CFO or a CEO, owner of a business, can sometimes be a very, very lonely experience. We have set up Small Business Samaritans so that they can call us and they can talk about, they can open up their hearts and their ideas to us, and we can really give them some good advice as to how to proceed. The other thing I wanted to mention is that, Eddie, you know that I'm a sales trainer. I've trained over 8,000 right. salespeople. And if you're a large corporation, you can invest in training, but many, many small businesses can't afford to invest in training. And so if you go to our Small Business Samaritan website, you'll see a list of all of the monthly seminars, we call them seminar events, that we're having. And you'll see that they'll cover things like customer service, women in business, financial management, dealing with customers, how to finance your business, work, developing a business plan, developing a marketing plan, et cetera. And we provide this training at a minimal price. Many of the corporations, and I work for some of the best corporations in America, they invested in their people But small businesses don't have those training budgets. And so we're trying to provide the same quality of training for a very, very low price.
But they may not have the budget, but they have no less of a need of it, because you really need your salespeople to be productive and get it going. Let me remind everyone once again that Phillips' website is smallbusinesssamaritans.com. And Philip has a great background. Philip's been with some large companies, IBM, Digital Equipment Corporations, Unisys, and some others. And he's a good speaker and a good trainer and has a great heart. Philip, we don't have too much time to discuss it, but I also know that you are also very active in church, and you've taught a Sunday school class for many years.
Yes.
Up at Hebron Church up there. I'm honored to have you here. Thank you for coming by and helping us out here. I want to remind everyone once again that today's broadcast here on Biz 1190 is also on eddiemayfield.com. There'll be a podcast on there following this program. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week on Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.